You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. You know, every day we are faced with moral choices. Right here on our streets and our sidewalks in downtown Los Angeles, within the library itself, there's that homeless man asking for change at the stoplight. What are you going to do? Are you going to pull out a dollar bill? Are you actually going to get out of your car and help him find a home? That's just a small example. What if your acute observations of human misery lead you to travel to Haiti during a cholera epidemic, or to adopt 23 special needs children, or perhaps to donate a kidney to someone you don't know? In the classic thought experiment about whether to save your drowning mother or two drowning strangers, what's the right answer? What's the right thing to do? What's the right answer for you? As Larissa Mafarquhar writes in her new book, quote, "Do-gooders are different from ordinary people because they are willing to weigh their lives and their families in balance with the needs of strangers." And this made me think about a Holocaust survivor I interviewed a few years ago. Barak and five other Jews from my family's town in Poland were hidden by a young woman who lived alone with her two young children. And Barak would not be alive today had this young woman not risked not just her own life, but the lives of her children to hide these refugees. And she didn't have to. Barak survived, and so did the others, including the woman and her children, but it could very easily not have turned out that way. Tonight we'll hear from two probing writers who each, in her own way, explores the phenomenon of impossible idealism, how people deal with the sometimes overpowering urge to help. Larissa Mafarquhar's new book is titled Strangers Drowning. You may have read her wonderful profile pieces in The New Yorker, where she's been writing for many years. And she's also been an editor at other magazines, and she's widely published. You have probably read her work in many places. Jessica Jackley's new book is Clay, Water, Brick, Finding Inspiration from Entrepreneurs Who Do the Most with the Least. Jessica is an entrepreneur focused on financial inclusion, the sharing economy, and social justice, and she's best known as co-founder of Kiva, the world's first and largest micro-lending website. And she's also a co-founder of Profounder, a pioneering crowdfunding platform for U.S. entrepreneurs. And Alex Cohen, we're welcoming back to the library tonight, is the co-host of KPCC's Take Two. Prior to that, she was the host of KPCC's All Things Together. It's considered really good tonight. She also hosted and reported for NPR programs, including Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Day to Day. And you may have had the pleasure of hearing Alex interview Judy Blume for Aloud or Jill Lepore. So we're delighted to welcome her back. And please welcome as well Larissa Mafarquhar and Jessica Jackley. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming out tonight, and thank you to Louise for the kind introduction. And I must say, I feel a little bit bad saying this after her kind introduction, but when they reached out to me about doing these two books together, and I've done many events here, I said yes, and I said, I don't really know what they're thinking here. I have no idea what they could possibly be talking about. Why this book with this book? I did not get the connection at all. I get it now. At the core of these two books is the notion of giving. When to give, where to give, how to give, why to give. Jessica, I'd like to start with you. Mm-hmm. You seem, when it comes to this desire to give, which is a big theme in both of your books, it seems almost to be wired into your DNA. Where do you think that trait came from, and when did you recognize that it was something that was within you?
But no pressure, right? thanks for the question, and it's really an honor to be here with both of you. I remember I've always felt driven by gratitude. I've always felt very grateful I don't have specific memories of growing up in my home, my family of origin, with my mom and my dad and my brother, and having it be this very overt, overboard sort of thing, like that we list off the things that we're grateful for. It's a practice, it's a habit, but I just always felt that way. I felt loved, supported, safe, and I think generosity, it's certainly easier to be generous and to feel generosity and to feel like you have something to offer to the world when you come from an environment like that. Mm. And so I definitely remember feeling early on like, I have everything I need and more. I'm the luckiest person in the world. What else could I possibly ask for? It's my job to give. And as I talk about a little bit in the book, there were definitely messages outside of my home from Sunday school and things like that where I felt I was taught that it was a good thing to care about the needs of other people who had less than you, not just anyone, right? A particular kind of person or a set of people, the poor. And I was fascinated by this, intrigued by it, kind of frustrated and confused by it too, and by the idea of serving the poor, what that meant, how that actually looked like day to day practically. So I think those two things were probably the biggest forces for me. One, feeling like I had everything and more in my life, all the good stuff, the good things, love, and then paired with sort of a place, a regular place and a community in my church on a weekly basis at very least, to think about and talk about these things from a young age and to think about what it means to be a person who lives out certain values. I think those things paired sort of planted the seeds in me.
Larissa, your book is entirely compiled of stories of people who share at least some things in common with Jessica in the sense that they are compelled to give, to do good in the world. Of all the things that you could write about, why write about this particular topic, the people who are compelled to do good?
Well, I will push back a little bit on the word compelled in a minute, but because it does sound awfully medical, awfully pathological. But I think the reason I started on this book project is that I found it puzzling that giving is pleasurable. It's even if it's a small thing, like a little bit of money, a seat on the bus, or if it's a big thing, a lot of money, or one of your kidneys, giving often makes you happier than keeping it. And we all know this, so why don't we give more? It's a puzzle, even if you think that people are only out for their own self-interest and pleasure. And so I thought I should go and meet some people who give almost as much as it's possible to give and see what their lives are like and how they think about their principles. I didn't know if they would live joyful lives or if they'd feel burdened by guilt. I didn't know if they would be thinking all the time about what they ought to do or whether at a certain point they figured out a set of principles and parameters that they could live with and put larger questions aside. So that's why I wanted to know what they did. But also, at the very early stage of the project, I encountered something that really surprised me, which is an quite intense skepticism and even hostility towards these people. I started with people who donated one of their kidneys to a stranger, and I thought, I went into it thinking, how extraordinary, what a wonderful thing to do. And so I was very surprised to find their families were pretty irritated with them. Why are you giving a kidney to a stranger? What about me? What if I need it, or if our children need it? And, or parents, if they were younger, the parents were like, don't put your life at risk. The doctors, the potential surgeons, often thought they were insane. And anyone who donates a kidney has to go through extensive psychological testing to make sure they're doing it for okay reasons, that they're not feeling forced by somebody. But people who give away a kidney to a stranger, the suspicion, as you can imagine, is all the greater. And the assumption was these people are probably nuts. So I became very intrigued by that too, which is why I want to push back on the word compelled.
Well, compelled, I think, in the sense that for a lot of these people, it was like, well, I have so much. How could I not? If I see people in need, how could I not? But you brought up kidneys, so I want to stay with kidneys for a moment, because this is one of my favorite profiles in the book. You talk about someone who decided to donate his kidney, and he chooses a recipient. He goes through the whole thing, and you've got to imagine, I'm putting myself in his shoes, I've done this brave courageous thing. I have sacrificed part of my body to someone. And then he gets, I forget how it came in, if it was by email, whatever. There was a woman who was next in line, or the person who was next in line, the spouse of that person.
Yeah.
Who just, well, tell what happens.
He's lying in his hospital bed post-surgery. And, you know, by the way, if anyone's considering it, donating a kidney is very safe and you feel fine very soon. However, right after the surgery, you feel terrible. So he's lying in his hospital bed, and yeah, the phone rings, and it's the spouse of, in the normal course of things, there's a list of people who, potential kidney recipients, and it's a very complicated algorithm, how they compile the list. But anyhow, this person's spouse was at the top of the list, and she screamed at him and said, how could you give to this other woman when my husband was next in line? Maybe you will have killed him. I hope you lose your other kidney. And, you know, basically felt that he was playing God for having picked the person. And he had done that because he wanted to feel a kind of bond with the person that he gave his kidney to. It's a very intimate gift. But she felt that was outrageous.
Can you imagine just being that guy? And I have to say, as awful as I felt for him, I could, and I think this is actually a testament to your writing, I also was putting myself in the shoes of that woman with the dying husband. And you hear this, I'd be... So what it gets to is that giving, which we just think of on the surface, it's good, it's right, it's so easy to do. It's not. It's thorny and it's sticky, which brings me back to you, Jessica. This is something you kind of stumble upon early on. There was a standard model in this country for who we gave to and how we gave to. And you kind of have this epiphany where you realize, you know what? This doesn't feel as good as it should. Sally Struthers is on the TV telling me, you know, for however many dollars a day, you can save a child's life. It seems so easy. But it didn't satisfy you. Why not?
Well, it's interesting because you bring up right away, right? You brought up right away that it giving does feel good. But I think it's very confusing. And often for me, in my experience growing up, it felt good after feeling terrible. And in fact, it was almost always following this period of time where I felt terrible. And I was, strangely, I realized the reasons that I felt terrible were because I was caused to feel terrible. It was marketing material. It was designed. The experience by well-intentioned nonprofits and NGOs and organizations that wanted to go help people first had somewhere decided, maybe not so consciously, that the way to get me to give the most was to first make me feel terrible and panicked and overwhelmed, heartbroken by the sad stories out there in the world of suffering and desperation and hopelessness, and then have me feel guilty, maybe even shameful about my own relative middle-class American wealth, and feel so bad that right when they would give the pitch to, you know, but you too can help. Call this 800 number. By the way, I was thinking the other day, I should stop doing this and just do this because phones look more like call this 800 number. Or
but now we'll text our donations.
I know. So whatever. My brain is calling on the phone. I don't even know how to, yeah. But call the 800 number, throw your change in the jar, text, whatever it is. But respond in this way so that you can help and make things just a little bit better. Even though I know that same like late night infomercial was scheduled to air the next night too at the same time, like it didn't make sense to me. A lot of things didn't make sense to me about it. But first, I was frustrated that I felt myself just respond in a reactionary way so much to give. And if I was very honest with myself, it wasn't just to feel good about actually doing something effective in the world. It was just to sort of make myself feel better, check it off the list, and kind of want to create distance immediately after I gave. And that disconnect really bothered me. The idea that somewhere deep down I had this longing, this yearning to be meaningful. I mean, I think we all feel this way, to be meaningful to someone else, to be important in someone else's life, to be helpful in the world in some way. But yet I felt like all the ways that I gave, mostly financially, but sometimes as I volunteered and gave of my time, ended up putting me at a distance, even a farther away from the person or the people, some group out there, that I so longed to help and to know. So I think that I ended up asking, did this interaction, this transactional thing, really end up doing more harm than good? Because here I am, sort of even farther away from this person in the world. Is that good? Will things ever get fixed? Will problems ever go away if distance is just created more and more as this cycle perpetuates itself. Because again, the next night, the same sad stories would be on, or new, fresh sad stories, and I would feel bad again until I would make myself feel better.
And then there's the dogs, and then there's the environment.
I know. It's never ending. I know. Yeah. It's never ending.
Someone I met actually had decided that making people feel guilty was a really ineffective way to solicit donations, and he came up with the opposite strategy. He said, you have this amazing opportunity. You could be Oscar Schindler. You know, he saved, 1,200 people, and then he would furnish some statistics about for X number of dollars, you can save a life. Imagine, you can do 100 times better than Oscar Schindler. How exciting. What an opportunity.
Mm. I thought you were going to bring up something different. I also wrote about this very briefly, but I remember realizing that some organizations knew exactly what they were doing, because there's a somewhat well-known case years ago where, and I didn't know it was well-known at the time, it was just unfolding in my life, but I got something from an organization that had somehow found me, and I had donated to, like, once in the past, a very small amount, and there's this interesting new strategy that they had employed. They sent a letter that said, donate now, and we promise we'll never bother you again. And it actually was very effective. It was incredibly effective.
It's
not for me. I was
like,
this is so weird.
But you found out that it was effective.
Well, I found out years later, like I was researching it and saying, was I crazy? I mean, I had saved it for a long time. And then I was trying to understand more about this campaign. And like, did anyone else notice this? Was this like a weird anomaly in the world that only I saw? I don't understand. And I dug a little bit. And apparently it was this campaign that was very well known over the years, because people did respond really well. Because they were sort of saying, look, we get it. We actually know what we're doing here. We're kind of annoying you and bothering you, and you kind of don't love hearing from us, even though we're trying to tell you it's a great opportunity. You can be even better than Schindler. Like, it's amazing, but I know we're kind of annoying about it. So just give, and you can, like, pay us off. You can buy us out. We'll never bother you again. And, like, people did. People gave it higher rates. Kind of crazy.
But then, like, what's the price point for that, right? That's like,
yeah,
now you can buy us off forever.
But it's so sad, because really, if people genuinely believe they can do these great things and the work will actually be done and their donation will make a big impact, you shouldn't want to never be bothered again by that. That's a very mixed message, to say the least.
And I think so far, for the most part, what you're talking about, Jessica, is something that I would imagine most people in this room can feel and have a sense of. And I'm going to take a guess that there are many people who do good within this audience. Larissa, the people that you write about are a little bit different, I'm going to imagine, than most of the people in this room. And for folks who haven't had a chance yet to read your book, I'd love for you to read a passage that kind of sets up what you're doing here and describes who this class of people are, these strangers drowning. And this comes relatively towards the beginning of your book. It's from a chapter that's titled, For Do-Gooders, It Is Always Wartime.
Thank you. This book is about a human character who arouses conflicting emotions, the do-gooder. I don't mean a part-time normal do-gooder, someone who has a worthy job or volunteers at a charity and returns to an ordinary family life in the evenings. I mean a person who sets out to live as ethical a life as possible. I mean a person who's drawn to moral goodness for its own sake. I mean someone who pushes himself to moral extremity, who commits himself wholly beyond what seems reasonable. I mean the kind of do-gooder who makes people uneasy. This person has a sense of duty that is very strong, so strong that he's able to repress most of his baser impulses in order to do what he believes is right. This is a struggle, but one that he usually wins. He rarely permits himself time off from work and spends little money on himself, so he has more to give away. He has his joys and pleasures, but they must fit. They must gain admittance. Because of this, there is a certain rigidity and a focused narrowness to the way he lives. His life makes ordinary existence seem flabby and haphazard. The standards to which he holds himself and the emotions he cultivates, care for strangers, a degree of detachment from family in order to care for strangers, indifference to low pleasures, can seem inhumanly lofty and separate him from other people. The life of a zealous do-gooder is a kind of human sublime, by which I mean that, although there is a hard beauty in it, the word beautiful doesn't capture the ambivalence it stirs up. A beautiful object, a flower, a stream, is pleasing in a gentle way, inspiring a feeling that is like love. A sublime object, such as a mountain or a rough sea, inspires awe, but also dread. Confronting it, you see its formidable nobility, and at the same time you sense uncomfortably that you would not survive in it for long. It is this sense of the sublime that I mean to apply to do-gooders. To confront such a life is to feel awe mixed with unease, a sense that you wouldn't survive in that life for long and might not want to. The do-gooder is both more and less free than other people. In the usual sense of the word, he is less free because he believes it's his duty to act in certain ways and he has to do his duty. But in an older sense, he is more free because he can control himself so his intentions aren't frustrated by weaknesses he'd rather not have. He knows that if he makes a promise, he will keep it, that if a thing is right, he will do it, that he will not turn away because something seems too hard. Because of this, his life is what he intends it to be. The usual way to do good is to help those who are near you. A person grows up in a particular place, perceives that something is wrong there, and sets out to fix it. Or a person's job suddenly requires heroism of him, and he rises to the occasion. He might be a priest whose church becomes a refuge in wartime, or a nurse working in a hospital at the start of a plague. Either way, he is taking care of his own, trying to make their lives better, lives that he understands because they're like his. He may not know personally the people he's helping, but he has something in common with them. They are, in some sense, his people. There's an organic connection between himself and his work. Then there's another sort of person who starts out with something more abstract, and a sense of injustice in the world at large and a longing for goodness as such. This person wants to live a just life, feels obliged to right wrongs or relieve suffering, but he doesn't know right away how to do that, so he sets himself to figuring it out. He doesn't feel that he must attend first to people close to him. He is moved not by a sense of belonging, but by the urge to do as much good as he can. There is no organic, necessary connection between him and his work. It doesn't choose him. He chooses it. The do-gooders I'm talking about are this second sort of person. They're not better or worse than the first sort, but they're rarer and harder to understand. It can seem unnatural to look away from your own people towards a moral idea, but for these do-gooders, it's not. It's natural for them. The first sort of person doesn't provoke the discomfort that do-gooders do. The first sort of person is often called a hero, and hero is a much less ambivalent word than do-gooder. A hero of this type comes upon a problem and decides to help. He's moved to do so by compassion for something he sees, something outside himself. When he's not helping, he returns to his ordinary life. Because of this, his noble act is not felt as a reproach. You couldn't have done what he did because you weren't there. You aren't part of his world. And you can always imagine that you would have done what he did if you had been there. After all, the hero is an ordinary person like you. The do-gooder, on the other hand, knows that there are crises everywhere, all the time, and he seeks them out. He is not spontaneous. He plans his good deeds in cold blood. He may be compassionate, but compassion is not why he does what he does. He committed himself to helping before he saw the person who needed him. He has no ordinary life. His good deeds are his life. This makes him good, but it can also make him seem perverse, a foul weather friend, a kind of virtuous ambulance chaser. And it's also why do-gooders are a reproach. You know, as the do-gooder knows, that there is always somewhere a need for help. The term do-gooder, of course, is often demeaning. It can mean a silly or intrusive person who tries to do good but ends up only meddling. It can mean someone who seems annoyingly earnest or priggish or self-righteous or judgmental. Benjamin Franklin gave up his quest for moral perfection when he realized, quote, that such extreme nicety as I exacted of myself might be a kind of foppery in morals, which, if it were known, would make me ridiculous, that a perfect character might be attended with the inconvenience of being envied and hated, and that a benevolent man should allow a few faults in himself to keep his friends in countenance. Love Benjamin Franklin. But even when do-gooder simply means a person who does good deeds, there's still some skepticism, even antagonism, in it. One reason may be guilt. Nobody likes to be reminded, even implicitly, of his own selfishness. Another is irritation. Nobody likes to be told, even implicitly, how he should live his life or be reproached for how he is living it. And nobody likes to be the recipient of charity. But that's not the whole story. There's a certain suspicion of do-gooders who work in NGOs because aid money is often wasted and sometimes harms the people it's supposed to help. But that's not the whole story either. Ambivalence towards do-gooders also arises out of a deep uncertainty about how a person ought to live. Is it good to try and live as moral a life as possible, a saintly life? Or does a life like that lack some crucial human quality? Is it right to care for strangers at the expense of your own people? Is it good to bind yourself to a severe morality that constricts freedom and spontaneity? Is it possible for a person to hold himself to unforgiving standards without becoming unforgiving? Is it presumptuous, even blasphemous, for a person to imagine that he can transfigure the world, or to believe that it really matters what he does in his life when he's only a tiny flickering speck in a vast universe? Should morality be the highest human court, the one whose ruling overrides all others? So yes, in the ambivalence towards do-gooders, there can be petty defensiveness, resentment of being reproached and having to justify one's choices. There can be petty annoyance, irritation with earnestness or self-righteousness or priggishness. But there are also powerful forces that push against do-gooders, which have nothing to do with any of these things, and which are not petty at all. Some of these forces are among the most fundamental, vital, and honorable urges of human life.
Thank you for that. That was great. Now, you use the word he there, but of course in this book,
right,
there are men and women, there are old and young. These are people scattered throughout the world. And with that kind of philosophical framework in mind for the kinds of people that you're talking about, can you pick, there's so many great examples in the book. Can you pick out maybe one to you of one person who really sums up who the do-gooder is and just tell us a bit about his or her work?
I guess I'll pick an example that's his and her. I wholeheartedly admire everyone in this book. Two of my very favorite people are Sue and Hector Badeau, who they had two biological children and adopted 20 kids who were special needs in the adoption sense of very unlikely to ever be adopted. And so in some cases that meant profound physical disabilities, in some cases profound emotional difficulties, and in some cases simply having too many brothers and sisters. They adopted, for instance, a family, well, six teenagers, brothers and sisters, at once. No one else was going to do that. So for them, they kind of, you know, in many cases, in most cases, I think the hardest thing for do-gooders to figure out is not overcoming selfishness, because these people are way beyond that. It's not, you know, not, there's nothing petty about them, but it's the conflict between family and strangers. And for Sue and Hector, it was a particularly complicated form of this because the strangers became family. So every time they thought about adopting a new kid or new kids, they would, once the kids were a certain age, they would hold a family meeting and ask what the kids thought about it. And they said, this is not a democracy. You know, you don't get to vote on whether or not there's a new child. That's too much of a burden for you. But I want to hear your opinion. And as the family got larger and larger, sometimes the kids would protest and they'd say, it's too many. We need more of your time. We need more of your attention. We feel like we're taking care of all the other kids. Also, it's too much. You have to stop. And this cut them to the quick because, you know, I really want to emphasize, this is a family. This is not an orphanage. You know, these kids are their kids. And you can imagine, anyone who's a parent, how that would make you feel. But, and this is what's different from them and regular people, they didn't say, okay, then we won't do it. They thought, okay, it will take some amount of time and attention and resources, these were not wealthy people, from the children we already have, our children. But if it vastly improves the lives of children who are yet still strangers to us, then it's worth it. And that's something that makes them different from almost everybody else.
They really are. Although I think what's interesting is that although I think most people in this room would think, I could never adopt 20 kids, reading your book, there is that sense where you could see, oh my gosh, they see this picture of this poor child who's been through X, Y, or Z. How could I not help? And I think so many of us have struggled with the, I feel this, but here's what I can do, here's what I can't do, or the icky feeling that you get from the blackmailing letter saying, if you just give once, we'll go away. Jessica, you saw a need. You saw a niche in all of this for a new opportunity, which is how Kiva came about. Mm-hmm. And let me know if your voice is up to it. I want to check it.
I can do this.
Yes.
I might have
okay.
to keep popping the cough drops, but sorry about that.
No worries. I would like you to read a section from sure. your book. This is a section called Micro Epiphany. And just to set it up a little bit here yeah. for what's going on in the book at the time, you are getting ready to marry your first husband, Matt, who you started Kiva with at the time you were at Stanford, and basically mm-hmm. what happens in this, it's a pretty pivotal moment in terms of how you approached giving.
Yes. Okay, let's do this. Excuse me. Microepiphany. The following summer, I took a month off for the wedding and honeymoon eventually returned to work at the business school. One evening, right before I was about to shut down my desktop computer in my office at Stanford and leave for the workday, I get an email announcing a lecture by a man I had never heard of before. He was going to be talking about something related to banking, but a different sort of banking. He was a banker to the poor. This sounded interesting and, frankly, a little suspicious. Why would the poor need a banker if they didn't have any money? Intrigued, I decided to sit in on the lecture anyway. The man's name was Dr. Muhammad Yunus. It was the fall of 2003, 3 years before Yunus and his Grameen Bank would be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for their work pioneering modern microfinance. But first, on the night I heard him speak, Yunus would change the course of my life. In 1976, Yunus had worked as a professor of economics at the University of Chittagong in Bangladesh. Sometimes he and his students would visit the nearby village of Jobra, where they would conduct surveys and do projects with people living in the poorest households there. Through one of these surveys, Yunus learned just how little money it took to free a group of women, all working as bamboo furniture makers, from a vicious cycle of predatory lending. Every day, the women borrowed very small amounts of money, a few dollars worth, from local moneylenders. The moneylenders set their interest rates extremely high, but the women had no other choice for funding. No one else would lend to them. With their tiny loans, they would buy the materials needed for their day's work, labor furiously to make their bamboo furniture, and sell it at a profit. But sadly, at the end of the day, they would pay nearly all that they had earned in profit back to the moneylenders. Sometimes they'd even owe more than they made, ending up deeper in debt than when they began. Eunice's survey results showed that for each of these women to break free from this cycle and have the capacity to buy her own materials, it would take only 856 takas, or about $26, for the whole village collectively. Eunice loaned the money to the women himself, interest-free, and collected small repayments every day at a small tea stand in the village. Remarkably, every single woman repaid her debt in full. Eunice's experiment in that small Bangladeshi village ultimately became the impetus for the establishment of the Grameen Bank, a pioneer in modern microfinance, including not just microcredit, small loans, but other financial products and services for the entrepreneurial poor. Of course, Grameen Bank began with and is best known for its microlending activities, empowering clients to start or grow businesses, invest in their homes, send their kids to school, or simply meet their daily needs. Today, the Grameen Bank has over 7.5 million borrowers, more than two-thirds of whom have lifted themselves out of extreme poverty, and has inspired countless other organizations around the world to follow Eunice's lead and serve the financial needs of the poor through microfinance. Why hadn't other institutions been serving the needs of this group already? Other banks did not want to go to the trouble of doing the paperwork required for such small loans, nor would they take on the risk of accepting borrowers who, like the women Eunice worked with, had no collateral to speak of. Unfortunately, when it comes to traditional banking services, you usually have to have money in order to get money. Thus, a large segment of the population, many of whom were women, had been deemed unbankable for a very long time and were shut out of traditional financial institutions. But Eunice's Grameen Bank and other MFIs like it have turned these traditional ways of thinking completely upside down. They focus on providing access to funding and financial services to the poor because they know that given the chance, these individuals can be extraordinarily successful clients and responsible borrowers. Worldwide repayment rates for microloan borrowers are upwards of 95%. And borrowers consistently demonstrate a determination to use the loans to expand their businesses and improve life for their families. The work of these pioneering MFIs has shown that investing in the poor is not only possible and sustainable, it is an effective means to empower people to lift themselves out of poverty. The night I heard him at Stanford, Eunice talked about microfinance as a movement with the potential to transform the lives of hundreds of millions of people around the world. Yet his story was inspiring to me because it was so accessible. He made it clear that he began his remarkable journey with just a few small steps that anyone could take. Eunice knew all kinds of fancy economic theories inside and out, but the real magic started when he stood up from his desk, traveled to a nearby village, and began interacting directly with the residents there. I pictured him walking around a village in Bangladesh, shaking hands, chatting with people about their lives, asking the right questions, and patiently listening to the answers. Then he took specific actions to address individual needs, reaching into his pocket and lending a few dollars that would have a remarkably powerful impact. But even beyond sharing an accessible, inspiring narrative of the birth of a world-changing organization, Eunice took my breath away as he spoke about the poor in a way I had never encountered before, as entrepreneurs. Listening to Eunice speak, I felt genuinely inspired, not devastated, not depressed, not panicked or guilty or defensive. His stories had not been of sadness and suffering, of desperation and hopelessness. These were stories of smart, strong, hardworking people who, with access to the right resources, could become entrepreneurs. This turned my understanding of poverty on its head. The people Eunice spoke of were not just sad faces on a brochure, synonymous with the issue of poverty itself. They weren't just charity cases or problems to fix, and they weren't just the recipients of endless and unquestioning generosity for the sake of my own moral character development. The environments into which these individuals had been born were the problem, and environments that denied them access to the proper tools to thrive. These were not weak, helpless people. They were people who were capable, tenacious, and resourceful. They were people I wanted to be around, not people I wanted to avoid. These were entrepreneurs. For the first time in a long time, I began to think about the big, overwhelming task of alleviating poverty as something that was actually possible, one person at a time, through a series of small, discrete steps, steps that could be catalyzed with a small loan and support along an entrepreneurial path. How is it possible that I had heard such different accounts about people living in poverty over the years? Who was telling the more truthful version of the story, Eunice or the nonprofits? I wanted to find out for myself. I wanted to hear more stories firsthand. Who were these people really? More important, who could they become? There was something else. If the people Eunice talked about were really entrepreneurs, people I respected and could relate to, then my role did not have to be that of a faraway observer or a passive donor or a scattered volunteer. If their story could be so different, so could mine. I could react to them differently. What could my role be now that I knew there was another side to the story? Who could I become?
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, of course, Jessica, who you become, is one of the founders of Kiva, which is now this incredibly successful microfinancing site. And for those who aren't familiar with it, you basically became the connector. You take this idea and you run with it, and you gave people, everyone, people here tonight, the opportunity to be that lender, yeah. No interest, with that 95% success rate of getting a return on investment. And you could look at it now and say, like, wow, this was really successful. But what I thought, and this, I think, is our opportunity for the comic relief of the evening. And when I see the movie version of Clay, Water, Brick, I see this is the scene that gets the big laughs, right?
Okay.
You have this great idea. You are ready to roll with it. You've got no money to do this whatsoever. So yes. You're kind of reaching out to every lawyer you know, and they're basically telling you you're crazy. And can you just explain why? Because I think it's really fascinating now. It's like, oh, Kiva, of course, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But you could see why pitching it at first might not have gone.
Yes, and you have to tell me if I give the answer that you're imagining that you want me to hit on, because I remember this being just, tell me if I get the funny part in there. So I remember walking into, I mean, anybody that would give us the time of day, I cold called, I have it in the book, I think it's 46 or 47 law firms. And I was like, I've heard this thing again, here's my phone, my Lord. Like I've heard there's this thing you do called pro bono services. And that means free. Will you help me for free? Anyway, I cold called so many different ones, and I visited, and I had meetings with a handful of lawyers too and other people. And I would explain this idea that we wanted to build a platform to allow anybody to lend $25 with no interest to a goat herder in Uganda, or, you know, the seamstress in Cambodia, our new friends that I had met during this time volunteering in East Africa. And most of the time, we would get negative feedback for a handful of reasons. One, there was a lot of skepticism around whether or not there would actually be a market for this 0% loan as a product for lenders. A lot of people would say, nonprofit folks would say, I'm sorry, that's not a tax-deductible donation. Nobody's going to want to do that.
because you don't get a tax break on the contribution. And then the more for-profit business community that I encountered would say, it's not an interest-bearing investment. There's no potential financial upside. No one's going to want to do that. It was like the worst of all worlds in their mind. But it turns out at $25, you don't, I mean, look, I have given a lot of things away to Goodwill, and I'll be like, that sweater was like worth $7. Like, it doesn't make a difference on my taxes. And so $25, it's not going to, you know, people would rather actually forget getting $26 back 3 years later. People actually did want to lend 25, have an interesting experience, keep in touch with the goat herder, see what happened, see a picture of the new goats, and like, here's the kids in school. And people wanted that, and they could get their money back and then relent. It wasn't so much the tax deduction, it wasn't so much the financial, the possible financial incentive. But so there were arguments around that, but there was also just a lot of skepticism around whether or not this could work. Lawyers would tell us, well, you're going to have to go audit, you know, Joe the goat herder if you want to do that. The SEC is going to show up at your door and arrest you. There was a lot of fear and a lot of criticism about the idea and actually how easy it would be in it to implement. But I feel like I didn't get anything funny in that.
Well, no. And to me, the funny part of it was because you realize on the street, like, you know that you genuinely want to help the goat herder in Uganda or whatever. But if you think about the context, too, this was at a time where everyone's getting an email. Hello, I'm a farmer in Nigeria. Yes. Right, you could see where like, people are like, this
is a
terrible
idea. That's why we started in
Uganda,
not Nigeria. No. No, it was funny. I mean, there's lots of things to laugh at in the journey. I mean, there are a lot of mistakes that I made and a lot of naivete, which actually really helped along the way. Yeah. But there are definitely, you could see people just their body language, like, fold their arms and start to like back their chair up during the meetings. They're like, I don't want to touch this with a 10-foot. I don't want to be anywhere near this idea. This is going to be a disaster. But it turns out it was not so disastrous. And we've had some drama, but.
And what's successful about it, which you've touched upon several times, is the fact that it is people connecting with people. Yeah. You're not just signing off a check knowing that you're going to help some 20 kids out there.
Yeah.
You are able to see specifically what your money is going to. You're able to get updates on how things go. And I think at one point you talk in the book about some very wealthy company approaching with $10 million saying, here, just take it, do something with it.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, this isn't going to work because there's no person-to-person connection. Larissa, with your lens on giving and what works and what doesn't and what satisfies and what doesn't, I'm curious your take on, and I know that you've read Jessica's book, this notion of giving's really going to only work if there can actually be a human-to-human connection.
Yeah, this is a very important question. And do you mind if I talk about kidneys again?
Kidney away.
I got a kidney point to make here. one thing that I found that was interesting among the donors who wanted to donate a kidney to a stranger is that there was a distinction between people who wanted to feel a connection and found their recipients online. There was a site called matchingdonors.com. I don't know if it's still up, but they wanted to find someone they felt something for, and they would the recipients would have a photo and a little bio saying, you know, I'm a single mother, age 35, or whatever it was, and you would know where they lived and all kinds of things, and so whatever kind you would know who you were giving to. But there were other donors who felt that was wrong, and they sort of agreed with that screaming spouse. They thought that's playing God, and that it's a more noble act not to know who you're giving to give in pure altruism.
Not to know or not to choose?
Both.
Both, yeah.
Because they felt that it was kind of tainting to expect gratitude. They didn't want to feel that they were doing it for reciprocation. Mm. They were doing it as a pure gift. And I didn't quite know what to think about that, because on the one hand, I see the purity of that impulse, the thought that you don't want the recipient to feel the burden of gratitude, which is considerable because there's no reciprocation possible when it comes to kidneys, and it's just a huge gift, and you can imagine a recipient wanting not to feel entangled in this bizarre relationship. But on the other hand, when I thought about the idea of giving into the void, into someone you will never know anything about, it's in a weird way not altruism, because there's no other there. You know, all you can see, all you can perceive as a giver is your own act. Mm-hmm. And so, but I don't know. I don't know what to think about it. And certainly this is one tension, one of the reasons that people are put off by certain kinds of do-gooders in the way that I use the term is the abstraction of their moral drive. I mean, that's why I drew that distinction in the passage that you asked me to read between heroes and do-gooders. A hero sees someone who needs help and helps them. And no one has a problem with that. That's just obviously the right thing to do. But someone who goes looking in a more abstract way for people to help. And for instance, there's a couple in my book whose form of helping is just to give money. And for them, that's a form of modesty. They feel, you know, we're just too... you know, middle-class Americans, what do we know? Probably the best thing we can do with our education and our situation is to give as much money as we possibly can to local NGOs who know what they're doing and who can do better things with that money than we can. Now, mind you, the woman of the couple is a social worker, so it's not like she's not helping people right in front of her, but she feels that's the best thing she can do. But many people whom I've told about them find that off-putting. They think it's not really helping because it's not moved by compassion for someone right in front of you. It's not that clearly human impulse that we all understand.
And there's no clear or clean answers.
No, there isn't. And I think it's, I personally have enormous respect for their modesty. And I think that, and I mean, it's funny because she not only considers it more important, her giving, than her social work, but she actually was really wrestling with the idea of whether it was okay to become a social worker, because even though she really wanted to and she loved the work and she'd always wanted to since she was a teenager, she went to Bryn Mawr. She could have earned far more money doing almost anything else, which would have enabled her to give more money and save more lives or improve more lives or relieve suffering or what have you. And was it okay for her to consider her happiness over the happiness of others in that way? And she wasn't sure.
I believe it was that same couple, and I'm going to use this as a segue to talk about limits, because we have a limit on our time. We are swiftly approaching audience Q&A, so I want you to start thinking about questions you might have. I think it was that same couple, forgive me if I'm wrong, where one of them liked to eat out and the other didn't, and so it became this thing of like, well, should we spend that money dining out or not? I'm trying to remember.
No one in my book eats out ever.
No, like spending money on
no restaurants in this book.
Yeah. Well, or here, maybe a better example of the limitations would be, we'll go back. If you return to the kidney, I'm going to return to Sue and Hector Badeau, the couple who adopted 20 children in addition to the two that they had. And it became this question for them. I mean, there were several times like, okay, this is it. But look at these kids. They do this. And that kept happening and happening and happening. And this is the reason why I will never work in an animal shelter. I couldn't, because I know my house would turn into a zoo, because where do you draw that line? Jessica, I'm curious for you, as you have watched Kiva over the years, I would imagine it's hard in your position. I would see all these projects and I would want to, oh, well, then I'm going to give my 300 here or my whatever there.
Lend. I'm just saying.
Lend. Sorry, you're absolutely right. Interest free. Was that ever an issue for you? I mean, obviously you need to be in connection with these people to see what's going on, but was it ever hard to say, okay, someone will lend to this person, but it can't be me because I can't help each and every individual.
No, you know, that's nice of you to even think that I might be like that. I am not, I mean, I am not the do-gooder. I am not a profile in here. I'm very clear on that. So I don't feel, look, I definitely, things keep me up at night. I think about need in the world. I think about things that I want to do and people that need help. It's in my mind and on my heart a lot, but I don't feel plagued the way I think. I used to have real moments of panic when I was a lot younger. I went to Haiti in high school. I think, yeah, it's in there too. And I remember coming back, and then it was like prom the next week, and it was like the most extravagant experience I'd ever had at that time in my life, like a dress that you wear one time. And like we rented a limo. We all listened to all our high school kids. These high school kids pooled our money and like had a limo, and I thought this is like the worst thing ever, and I kind of had a breakdown. I'm still in touch with my prom date. Like we got through it, but oh my gosh, I like started freaking out. Anyway, I think for me, I believe in focus and I believe in setting boundaries for your own wellness and your own sanity so that you can be effective in what you are doing. And I think a lot of folks working in the social sector and the nonprofit sector, there's so much to talk about here, but there are organizations that have a little bit more of a holistic approach. As somebody I mentored in business school went off and started one of these kinds of organizations, and they'll go into a village and they'll like do everything that needs done before they move on to the next place. I would go bonkers. I think there's always more to be done. everywhere all the time. And so to have helped start something and to have guided it for a while to focus on something very specific. I mean, we get asked, Kiva got asked all the time, why don't you also do this kind of business trainer or connect people with mentorship opportunities who are lenders and want to do more? Or why can't I take a trip and like visit all the borrowers and be more inspired? And there's always more things you can do. So I guess I believe in focus at the organizational level and at a personal level. If I can say one thing about the donating, Jen and the other guy, they're the effective altruists, right, that you were referencing earlier?
Julia and Jeff.
The J's.
Yeah.
I have one of those names too. I've thought about that a lot, the effective altruism path. And to me, I mean, I've noticed over the years, I am actually weirdly, I feel almost guilty about this, but I'm sort of more excited about the changes that have happened in some of the lives of the lenders that I've talked to with Kiva as opposed to the borrowers. Maybe perhaps because it's been more surprising to me, but I feel like it's a small thing, and maybe the changes seem small and are more invisible. But when I talk about that, I've talked about that distance earlier tonight that's created when the privileged, when we, very, very privileged people sitting in this room, more or less, have these opportunities to participate and to help somebody else. And it changes the way we see ourselves. It changes the way we, you know, it affects the way we see each other. I get really excited when lenders feel more connected to another person because of their experience. I think to participate, to choose, to attempt, it's messy and it doesn't always work perfectly, and maybe you don't get repaid. Maybe you feel like you've chosen poorly. You certainly, you know, there's always more to know and always more to learn. But I love when people try in this messy, scrappy, like they're going to throw more at the problem or at the effort than just money, even when it's just my personal preference. It's taste more than anything else. But I love seeing that happen. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that's made me the happiest about Kiva, to see people kind of get in there and be inspired to do more because it feels approachable. It's not as scary, and it's not, again, something that makes them feel bad first before they have an option to feel better.
There's so much overlap between your two books, and yet these are two very different books in a lot of ways. Jessica, you are the story. This is your memoir. These are your experiences. Larissa, your book is reporting, and really excellent reporting. We were talking about this earlier today. I was saying to Larissa, I really didn't have any idea sometimes how I felt about these people and what they were doing. There was moments where I was like, this is great. And there were moments I'd be like, what are you doing? This is a terrible decision. And more importantly, I didn't know how you felt about them, which is actually a very tricky, it's a rare ability, I think, that a writer has to be able to just present it in a blank slate in that way, because you're obviously spending time with these people, you're having intense conversations. I'm not going to have you weigh in on whether or not you think they are doing good, but I'm curious.
Yeah.
Where does it leave you in terms of giving? You know, you go through this whole experience of writing a book, and be it walking down the street and you're in New York and a homeless person asks you for money, or you get the letter from that charity you gave to 7 years ago. Are you a different person now in terms of the choices you make?
I mean, yes, in many small ways. I mean, I didn't know. I was very haphazard in my giving before I started talking to these people. I would make guesses about charities that were doing good work, but I would guess were not receiving as many funds as they needed, and others, you know, I thought, well, maybe cancer care is maybe well-funded and homelessness is less well-funded. I would just guess. And then I found an organization called GiveWell, which is a kind of consumer reports for charities, which is a superb organization. I've gotten to know several of the people who work there, and I respect their research enormously. So that is a concrete change. But, you know, I'm not one of these people, and part of the reason I wrote this book was to think about some of the reasons I'm not, because I, you know, like Jessica and like I'm sure many people in this room, when I was a kid, felt overwhelmed by thoughts of need in the world and what was I going to do about it, and this is going to age me, but I thought I should work for Mother Teresa, and, you know, had all these, and I didn't do those things. I did something I love, which is be a writer, and I've never been completely comfortable with that, so I thought I should talk to these people and try to figure out why I and so many other people don't persist in those childhood impulses that these people have followed through so extraordinarily.
I'd like to open it up
to questions. We've got microphones. If you've got something you'd like to ask of Larissa, Jessica, or both of them, please raise your hand. And I believe
right down here.
Yep, right down here. You sit right in front.
The idea of charity has fascinated me and what goes into it, but I was wondering if you can relate your experiences or your understanding of what calculations go into people's minds when they're giving and how that is a factor of the timing of their giving. In other words, if somebody is drowning in front of you, you're going to take care of it right away. But if you're thinking about giving up a kidney, you're going to wonder, will someone in my family need this later on, or will I suffer a complication? So what kind of calculations go into the giving in the in your various examples in your books?
You can take this first.
It's a poor thing. Well, as I said in that passage, I mean the one of the big differences between the kind of person I'm writing about and regular people is that they are not reacting to things that they see right in front of us. I mean, you know, almost anyone would do that, I would hope. One of the reasons the book is called Strangers Drowning is the philosopher Peter Singer has this famous thought experiment. He said, suppose a child, you were walking along and you see a child drowning in a shallow pond, shallow meaning there's no threat to you. Would you save that child even if it meant getting your clothes muddy? And of course, everyone's like, of course, we would save the child. You'd be a monster not to, right? It's very easy. And he said, well, aha, but there are children drowning or dying of some other cause all the time. They're not right in front of you. But are you less obligated to help them for that reason? What is the moral relevance of physical distance? Now, I happen to think that physical distance is a very, very deep thing in humans, and it's not morally irrelevant. But it's a very clever and compelling argument, and the people I'm writing about think like that too. They think there is no relevance to distance, and I think actually part of the thing that makes them able to think that way is that they have an extraordinary moral imagination. I think there is a vividness to their imagination of suffering that many of us don't have. A child in front of us, or that poor child whose photograph everyone in the world has seen in Europe, that compels any one of us. But to imagine that child, not just in the abstract, but vividly, and to conjure it out of nowhere, that's a kind of moral genius that I think we don't all possess.
If you don't mind, I'm going to relay that question to Jessica in a somewhat different way, because that question made me think of the different, throughout this book, Jessica describes different projects that Kiva has been able, different people and their projects that Kiva's lent money to over the years. And I remember there was reading one, I believe she was a woman in Brazil who has established this incredible business working with women. She was a hairstylist, and her big claim to fame was that she was able, especially for the women who had hair that probably looks a lot like mine, being a hairstylist for them and creating this idea and this notion that you could have natural beauty. And it was, to me, I know if I'm clicking through Kiva, that's where I would have, if I saw a project like that. And it's because of the emotional distance, because I know what it's like to be a woman who feels like what you are naturally born with is ugly, and I know the importance of feeling it was beautiful. So I would give to that, which doesn't mean that any of the other thousands of ideas out there aren't as good, but do you find that when people give, there is that emotional proximity?
Yes. I don't feel prescriptive about why people should give, or even that they should, or lend. I'll correct myself, on Kiva in particular. And I love hearing people's explanations and just understanding. I'll meet kids who say, our classroom chose this guy because there's a fluffy sheep in the picture. And I'm like, great. And I'll meet, I met a CEO from Oregon who was like, well, and he had this really long, I thought he was going to pull out a spreadsheet, but this very highly calculated way of choosing the next people. And I was like, good for you. And then you'll meet people who say, oh, this woman was a single mom of three kids and I'm a mom of three kids. Done. It's not like they're incredibly they're not trying to make any sort of case or argument. They were just being very honest about what they felt and why they decided to contribute. And I love that. I just love that people are even considering it and that it's captured their attention even in a small way. I don't know if it's hard. I don't know if this is just like everyone knows this or not, because it's been repeated a lot in the work that I've been most familiar with. But it's been interesting to look back at Kiva's growth and success. And I forget if this was said or not, but I still have to pinch myself when I hear these numbers. I mean, it's been 10 years, and we'll be able to say the B word soon. I mean, Kiva's about at $760 million in loans and these little $25 bits in like more countries than the UN recognizes. So it's grown a lot. And as I've watched that, I think it's been interesting to try to figure out what's worked, what's been because of things that were intentional that Kiva's done, and despite things, you know, mistakes made along the way. And one thing that I've come to learn is that if I say a statistic, like children are starving and every day, I don't even want to say sad things, children are starving. Maybe people, you know, give a dollar if they give it all. If I say children are starving and here's a picture of one of them, it's like 2x, right? Mm. Children are starving, here's a picture of one of them. By the way, he likes to play ball and his favorite color is orange. $3. These extra details, the ability to help people to spell out if they don't have that strong moral imagination, it does change the way that we are generous. And so I think your explanation makes total sense to me. And as I look at Kiva, I mean, we thought they were interesting stories and they have a ton of detail and they're the stories as told as much as possible by the entrepreneurs themselves, not, you know, however the org, you know, we didn't want to craft them or sort of direct them. We just wanted people to be able to represent themselves as they would represent themselves. But it's turned out that there are a lot of elements in the specificity. Just having picture after picture after picture of hundreds of thousands of borrowers at this point does something very special when it's specific. Hmm. And you don't have to use that strong moral imagination to fill in the gaps.
Hi, I work on labor issues in global supply chains, like with seamstresses in Cambodia who provide products that we all buy. And one of the gap areas that we've seen over many years is the disconnect with consumers who surveys have shown aren't really willing to pay more for something that's ethically produced or that might cost more to produce in that manner. And I wonder, in your opinion, both of you, is this kind of a gap just because the givers are a unique group and there's no hope to bring kind of the mass consumer populace into something like ethical purchasing? Or, you know, is there another way to tap a large group of people that hasn't been done yet in consumer products, for example?
So my mind is a little foggy because I have taken some cold medicine and it's very obvious that I'm not feeling my best here. So I cannot pull out the statistics that I have come across that might counter what you said, but in my experience, and I'll get your email and I'll send you and we can figure it out, right? We'll figure it out with the numbers that we can each find. But I've actually seen information to the contrary that especially younger consumers are very willing to pay extra to support something that they know as, great, take a picture of that one, that they know has been produced in a fairer or more just way. So I've actually seen evidence that says that that's different. And I do think in a broader way, there people are more concerned. I do think it's a trend that's happening. People are more concerned with sort of values-based consumption. They want all of their actions. They want their actions to mean something. Sometimes I think people get thrown off when they're in purchasing mode. They're in buying and consumption mode. So it's a big shift for some people to then go into giving mode. So it's a little dissonant for them to say, wait, I want that thing. I'm not trying to give anything away right now. I'm trying to get this thing. So I believe that'll get blended more and more in the future, and it won't be so strange or dissonant for certain people.
To introduce a note of cynicism here, there have been surveys of ethical consumption and how they affect the rest of people's behavior. And unfortunately, there seems to be, for a lot of people, a kind of zero-sum game. So it may be that the people who are looking at your products have just bought ethically produced coffee down the street, and because these studies have shown that if you do some small ethical thing, like buy, you know, moral coffee or moral chocolate, that you will feel so you've done your thing for the day, and so you'll, you know, if someone needs help crossing the road, you'll be like, go away, I'm already good, thank you very much. So
Which, much Wait, like actually, having the Diet Coke with the brownie, absolutely does not work.
Exactly. Same dynamic.
Actually, I'm so guilty of this. I was very close. I like actually drafted it, but then I didn't print it out and mass produce them. But I wanted to basically like put my cure my philanthropic priorities, and I wanted to give it to the guy outside of the grocery store who's always like asked me to sign petitions because I'm like, no, I'm already doing stuff. I already have I have my game plan. But sadly, that really resonates.
Yeah. You just have to get them first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
The issue of priorities has something to do with the question I was going to ask you, and that is, in the work that you've both done, how do people balance the issue that, on the one hand, if I work and I've got a demanding job and I can only spend a little time directly helping people out, but I can write checks that way, versus somebody that says, well, if I leave this demanding job, instead of spending 2 hours a week, maybe being in a homeless shelter, I can spend 10 hours a day doing it, but then I can no longer write those big checks. I can write a little check or something. And I'd be curious just either your thoughts or when you were preparing your books, how people have dealt with that dichotomy.
This is something that comes up with effective altruists a lot. These are people who think about giving or try to think about giving in as rational a way as possible. The idea being to do as much good in the world as possible and not care about things like who does the good or how it makes you feel. And there was a dinner I attended that was given by an effective altruist couple where, which I describe in the book, where most of the people at the dinner subscribed to this rational form of giving, but there would always be outsiders who weren't really familiar with their way of thinking. And that at this dinner, there were three young Israeli students who came, and one of them was a medical student, and he had spent the previous summer in Kenya setting up from scratch a children's health clinic. And he'd found this very inspiring. He'd been very devastated to see how much... He'd never been to the third world before, so it was more poverty than he had understood, but he was very inspired as well as devastated, and he planned to do more such things in the future. And he was very startled to discover that the effective altruists didn't really... They thought this was nice, but they said, you know, to be honest, you're going to be a first world doctor. You can earn a ton of money. Suppose you have your 3 months in your summers. Do you really want to go there and be one doctor, doing your best, but you're just one doctor? Or do you want to stay home, keep working, earn a pile of money, and give that away to pay for, you know, five or six doctors? And their feeling was, it's not important who does the help. That's narcissism. What's important is that people are helped. And this student was just... very startled by this and thought, you know, basically you're saying it's not important how a human being spends his time on Earth, and in this case, me, spends his time on Earth, and what does that mean? So it was a very striking contrast of worldviews, and, you know, I think they're both right in some way.
Oh, I don't think they're both right. That drives me crazy. I mean, the idea...
Which one?
Well...
effective altruism.
Obviously, I mean,
of course,
right?
Connection.
I know. Come on. I think because, I went to business school. I have an amazing classmates, and I've seen a lot of people take a path like that, like, and do corporate jobs where they're building up big corporations, or they're spending time investing very wealthy people's money to make them wealthier. And I just think the bulk of what they are, not my classmates, but I see people doing particular kinds of work, being a doctor. Is its own thing. But I know that there are effective altruists out there that are iBankers or whatever they're doing. No offense to iBankers. But building up something during the bulk of their waking hours.
Yeah.
And then I don't care how much money you give on the side, it's a drop in the bucket compared to like this monstrous thing that this big thing that you might be working on during the majority of your time with the majority of your resources and your brain power. So anyway, I totally disagree. But I, with that person, not you. But I had another thought I wanted to contribute that is from my world. I guess I'll just say this. I do feel sad sometimes, and I think it's actually kind of lazy thinking when people put forth this idea that there's such a dichotomy. Either I have to go work at some job, and it's like this black box job, something, probably with a big business, and make money, or, you know, and give it away, or I have to go serve the poor or work with people and do something good in the world, but then I won't have enough money to go. No, you don't. That's intellectually lazy to think that you can't do something that you believe in and that you feel like is going to serve people and help people and can make a social impact and also capture some value for yourself and be smart about how the machine that you build or contribute to that's doing good in the world runs. I mean, I know people that work in nonprofits that make perfectly good livings, maybe slightly less sometimes than if they were selling their soul to some other thing. But I think overall, the sum total is way better when they're actually spending their time and their energies and their creativity thinking about, all as again, during the majority of their waking hours, how to solve these problems and contributing money and contributing everything that they have into it while still making a living and doing just fine for themselves and having a savings account and being able to pay for school for their kids and all that good stuff. So I guess I've already said it. That's what I think.
One final question.
In these times of low interest rates, why can't Kiva pay 2%? Wouldn't that level the playing field in terms of the moral?
No, so I should explain. So Kiva is made up of lenders, the actual platform, the field partners, these microfinance institutions and other lending organizations all over the world, and there are thousands and thousands of them. Kiva worked with a few hundred at any given time, and borrowers. So lenders, the Kiva platform, partners, and borrowers. Those partners exist out in the world with or without Kiva, and they're lending, they're finding entrepreneurs, administering loans, collecting repayments with interest. The interest is happening. Sometimes the interest is 30%, and Kiva works only with organizations that they believe are charging a fair and appropriate interest rate based on like the value exchanged, and I can talk more later if you'd like. So that's happening in the world. The lender experience and the Kiva experience is just simply without interest. So the process is as follows. Lender goes to the site, sees, you know, browses profiles of entrepreneurs, chooses one that makes them feel something maybe, or maybe very rationally just picks somebody or arbitrarily, lends their $25, it goes all the way through into the hands of the borrower, that borrower repays maybe $26, $27, whatever it is. The microfinance institution keeps that interest, then passes the principal back through Kiva back into the hands of the borrower, or to the lender. So there is interest that's happening out there. Yeah, that's the experience for the lender. Great.
You know, I think of children as naturally altruistic, and then somehow that for a lot of children just gets lost along the way. I don't think they have the models, or they don't have the place to put their energy, because so much of what you need to do is either having money to donate or being able to spend time or resources that as a child you can't do. So I'm struggling with this idea of I have a lot of nieces and nephews. They love going on my Kiva portfolio and picking
That's
people
great.
To donate to. And, you know, we do things like, you know, we're trying to do more projects and other things. But I don't know if either of you had ideas or if you'd come across experiences of what we can do to not let our children lose the instincts that I think are more of a do-gooder instinct, and then it just gets lost over time.
And if I could just add to that, because both of these women are mothers and have that practical experience, and one of the things that you've talked about tonight, and I think I've experienced this, I think we all have, is that when you're a child and you hear there are X many poor people in the world, there are hungry kids in Ethiopia, so whatever, there's so much fear that's connected yeah. with all of that. And I think it's the fear that has propelled a lot of the do-gooders in your book. So how can you explain what's really going on in the world and keep that altruism in check without simultaneously instilling fear? Because I think that's very strong in kids.
Well, something I read in the course of researching this book really, really struck me as a mother, which is I was reading the work of Samuel and Pearl Oliner. Samuel Oliner was a Holocaust survivor. He was a teenager who was taken in by a Catholic woman and protected and taught to pass as a Catholic, and that's how he survived the war. And afterwards, the two of them were sociologists, and they made a study of people, ordinary people, and why some were rescuers and why most were not. And there's lots and lots of details, and it's a fantastic study for anyone who's interested in this. But one detail that stood out to me was they found that a lot of the people who did not rescue had been raised in a very traditional fashion to be obedient and to do what they were told and sort of raised very, very strictly. and that this produced in them a sense that they couldn't do very much about the world, that they didn't have much power, that they were small people, and that they just had to keep their heads down and do what they were told. And the rescuers had been raised with various moral principles that also guided them, but another equally crucial factor was that they were raised leniently and given the sense that they could do, should find their own way and do what they wanted to do. And this gave them a sense of power, that they could affect the world, that it mattered what they did, and that they could change something, even something very large. And that really struck me.
I mean, I would wholeheartedly agree with what you said. And I feel, as a parent, I mean, I don't have the research to reference except for my own little experience as a mom of my three boys. But I think we try to give them age-appropriate ways to sort of figure it out together. As they're, it's similar, right? As they participate in figuring out what could we do to solve this problem? What could we do to help this person that needs something? Often, and this is like a lesson for all of us, the solutions aren't mysteries. It's not a mystery. I mean, people are hungry. It's not a mystery how to help them. It's really not. They need food, right? It's just there are certainly some other things that we need to try to figure out how to fix, but a lot of the solutions to problems, a lot of the ways that people need helped in the moment are quite simple and straightforward. So I think it's a safe and not scary way to allow your kids to start to get involved by just asking them, what do you think happens next? What do you think could be helpful? And to teach them to be good listeners to other people, allow them early on to get engaged in a very direct, personal way.
The title of this evening was Impossible Idealism, but I hope that everyone comes away not thinking that idealism is impossible and does feel compelled to help and give where they can. Certainly, you can check out Kiva, and I know there are so many worthwhile endeavors there to loan to, and I don't want to steal any thunder from that. But I also want to just take a moment to think about the place that we're sitting in right now. This library is a phenomenal institution. There are phenomenal libraries throughout this great city that share books, which is a priceless value, but do so much more beyond that, including events like this evening. The Los Angeles Public Library Foundation, they cannot do it without your help. I'm going to try to go back here to where I'm not going to do the doom and gloom and say the books will all vanish and disappear if you don't help now. Just give $50 and you'll never hear from us again.
Is there an 800 number involved?
There's no 800 number. But if you are curious about how to get involved and how to participate, I do strongly encourage you talk to Louise, who is here this evening. You can go online and find out. But do give because you can accomplish extraordinary things like this evening. Larissa and Jessica, my thanks to you both for
being here. Thank you.
My thanks to everyone here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.